evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, June 12, 2019. Ebola cases are reported in Ugandan town close to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
All our health facilities were quickly informed to be on alert. The child was detected by the health workers. A blood sample was drawn and sent for testing at Uganda Virus Research Institute, and the sample tested positive for Ebola.
And a South Sudanese legal expert says lawyers get intimidated during court hearings.
There was a serious intimidation in the air. I would sit with some officers in the dock where the lawyers only sit. So they have just promoted themselves of certain to be lawyers, and they are sitting with me in the dock where lawyers normally sit in the bench.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A 5-year-old boy has died of Ebola in neighboring Uganda in the first cross-border case of the virus since an outbreak began last year in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Ugandan health officials are mobilizing to prevent the virus from spreading to other parts of the country. Halima Athumani reports for VOA from Kampala.
Ugandan health officials said the boy and five family members crossed into Uganda on June 10th from eastern Congo, where health workers have been fighting an outbreak of Ebola that has infected more than 2,000 people. More than two-thirds of those patients have died from the hemorrhagic fever caused by the virus. The young boy was the first confirmed Ebola case in Uganda since the outbreak began. Uganda's health minister, Ruth Aceng, says the boy's family members have been isolated and are being tested for Ebola.
Here in the Ebola treatment unit, the 5-year-old who tested positive first, who passed away at 9:30 p.m. last night. Right now, his grandmother and his younger brother, 3-year-old, have also tested positive, bringing us to a total of 3 confirmed cases. We have 7 suspects.
Ugandan officials said the Democratic Republic of Congo alerted them on Monday to the family's border crossing after they visited a relative in the DRC who later died of Ebola. The family was found when they checked into a border area hospital after the boy fell ill. Uganda had already stepped up controls on the border in an effort to prevent Ebola from entering the country. Aceng says Uganda, the World Health Organization, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, are now taking steps to stop the virus from spreading further.
The Ministry of Health, WHO and CDC will undertake ring vaccination of contacts to the case and other non-vaccinated frontline health workers, as well as other workers beginning 14th June 2019. Uganda's preparedness has been converted into a response mode.
But Red Cross Emergency Preparedness and Response Manager Paul Okot warns the border checks cannot fully control movement from the DRC.
There are a lot of informal crossing points that people pass through. They have relatives across the border and they cross anyhow. For us, we are stationed at official border points that the immigration people have gazetted. Sometimes they cross when we are not at the station. We close the border at 7, and so our screening teams also leave the border points at 7.
Uganda's Ebola outbreak in 2007 killed 22 people in the western district of Bundibujo. The country's worst outbreak was in 2000 when 425 people were infected with Ebola and half of them died. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
From Kampala, we move back to Juba, where military officers representing various parties to the revitalized peace deal say they worry they may not complete the pre-transitional activities within the remaining 5 months of the pre-transitional period, which ends in November. A Juba-based analyst warns that unless the parties speed up those activities, the peace deal could collapse. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
It has been a month since the former warring parties extended the pre-transitional period by 6 months, but military officers representing various parties to the revitalized peace deal say very little has happened in that time. Major General Björn Lik, who represents the former detainees, says the delay in carrying out pre-transitional activities is partly due to a failure by the ceasefire monitoring body to conduct meetings to address the challenges affecting security arrangements. He says in the past month, Citizam VM has never convened a meeting with the former warring parties to discuss how to implement the pre-transitional activities or visited cantonment sites to verify troop numbers and sites.
We have slowly, steadily going into all days, replacing the objective of achieving peace for the people of South Sudan. I never had any ceasefire that can conduct its business after 50 days, as it is today. We, in the technical committee, we are trusted by the parties to visit, to see, to go to containments, but that one is not there.
Major David Nyang, who represents the South Sudan Opposition Alliance at Citizam, confirms that over the past month, military officers from the parties to the peace deal have yet to visit cantonment sites and verify the troop numbers.
And as I have been urging in many meetings, that our presence here should not just be by sitting after a long time, as mentioned by my colleagues. We are here to work. And we are here to be used in many fields that need our intervention. Thank you very much.
For his part, Brigadier General Chol Rai, who represents Riek Machar's SPLM-IO, warns the parties against delaying pre-transitional activities. Rai says the government's lack of commitment to fund the pre-transitional activities has caused delays in implementing security arrangements, which paves the way for forming the transitional government at the end of November.
It is good that the parties actually extended the ISIS for the next 6 months, of which the 1 month finished. But how far the government is very committed to put in the resources that is being requested, because we should not only keep extending the ISIS.
James O'Cook, a political analyst at the Juba-based Center for Strategic Studies, says next to nothing has been completed in the way of security arrangements despite the extension.
No significant progress is being made in the security arrangements, and the blames are already on the skies. And this is what also each and everyone is afraid of. Maybe everybody wants to jump out from this board so that they are not blamed.
O'Cook says citizens and some politicians worry about the consequences of delaying security arrangements.
If the situation goes on like this and no progress is made towards completing the necessary unification of the forces, then we don't expect Victoria to come back to Juba to assume his position as the first vice president. And if he does not come back to Juba, and there is no any another renewal of the agreement, it means we are back to square one. And that's what is scaring everybody now.
Samantha Minga, communications officer for Citizam VM, says Desta Abiche Ageno, the Citizam VM chairperson, is not in a position to talk to the media. She says Ageno will respond to concerns raised by the former warring parties in a report to be issued at a specific date. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Amnesty International blasted yesterday's High Court ruling in Juba that sentenced South Sudanese activist and economist Peter Bier Ajak to 2 years in prison for his role in an alleged uprising at the Blue House in October. Businessman Carbino Wall was also sentenced to 13 years for allegedly leading the uprising. Adoti Akwei, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Advocacy and Government Relations, says there is a possibility the rights of the two South Sudanese were violated during the course of the trial.
We are appalled at the ruling. We believe that the trial was not legitimate, There were consistent reports of the presence of security forces in the courtroom from the NSS and the military, basically creating an atmosphere of intimidation. We have received reports of efforts to intimidate legal counsel for the defendants. So it's hard to see how the proceedings could be conducted in a could be considered fair and just when the state was using every possible means that it had in its power to intimidate and to basically ensure a conviction.
Amnesty International calls the trial, quote, a sham. Amnesty says they also have reasons to believe that the lawyers of the defendants and some witnesses have been intimidated and harassed during the course of their trial. Akwai says there is a need for a fair and transparent review of the trial.
We believe that the trial needs to be scrutinized or looked at properly. Excuse me, the ruling needs to be reviewed and probably appealed. Or we believe that the men must be granted a retrial in a situation where fair principles and due process or standards are met internationally as well as regional standards.
Amnesty International says national security agents had an overwhelming presence in the courtroom. Akwai also questions the motive of the government in this case.
I think that there's enough concerns about how the trial, first of all, about their detention and the controversy about the charges, not to mention that the initial charge was already a week old when he was arrested in 2018. All of these things basically suggest that the government is doing whatever it can to get a conviction and to basically isolate and put these people out of being active. So that raises questions about whether there are legitimate charges at all, or whether this is just indeed a government targeted campaign against these individuals.
That's Adoti Akwai, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Advocacy and Government Relations, speaking to us here in Washington. The lawyer of Karbino Wolagok, who was sentenced to 13 years in prison, says his client did not get a fair trial. Ajak Mayol Bior says the presence of national security officers during court hearings intimidated him and the judges who presided over Wol's case. Wol was charged with masterminding an alleged uprising at the national security headquarters in October. Mayol says the detention of Wol for more than 6 months at the Blue House without trial was against South Sudan's constitution.
The trial was not fair. The sentencing was actually misplaced. In the legal system all over the world, there are principles that are laid down where if you go against them, then it generates a penalty. For you to arrive at giving that penalty, there is a procedure that is dictated by law. Our constitution is clear that under section article 19.4 is very clear that you can never be held for more than 24 hours. That alone can invalidate whatever happened after that. If at all there is no reason that is found to hold you, they can let you free. If they don't let you free, then they have to charge you in a court of law and let the court take over the procedure. This was not the case to my clients. Two of my clients were detained from 2017, May, on different charges, which until today they haven't seen the court for those charges. Karbino Wol and others who were with him too were detained in 2018, and by the time they were brought to court for the incident that happened in October, they have already been in for over 6 months.
Now, let's look at it from the point of the constitution of the country, that anybody who is arrested is supposed to be produced before a court of law within 24 hours. Given the fact that Karbino was produced after 6 months with his colleagues, what would you have done to pressure the judiciary to dismiss the case?
Well, we have done our application to that light during the proceeding throughout it, and they were all denied. There was a serious intimidation in the air. I would sit with some officers in the dock where the lawyers only sit. So they have just promoted themselves of sudden to be lawyers, and they are sitting with me in the dock where lawyers normally sit in the bench.
I mean, you are saying that there were serious intimidation in the air. Who was intimidating you?
Well, the officers who were detaining the accused them, they were everywhere. People are seated with me. And in a normal circumstance, John, accused is an accused. And the law, our constitution has it that everyone is innocent until proven guilty. The same constitution dictates it that you have to be arraigned in court and given a fair litigation. A fair litigation in a sense that there is a police in the court. Whoever is accused of any crime is given to court police. The court police will take security of the whole court. Now, if there is another unit that believes that these people are not safe in the hand, and now the only thing they will do is to come and sit with me, give me all the feeling that the environment is not safe. And that was what I was in. That was what everyone was under, including the judges.
According to you, the judges and everybody involved in seeing the case were intimidated by the presence of officers from a different division. Were these national security officers?
Yes. Well, John, to tell you the truth, if at all I happen to be questioning all this and say, let me move to the higher court and to the highest court, the time will still. I'll be adding the suffering of my clients who have already suffered. I'll be putting them back to the same illegal detention they are in. It will be an ending proceeding. But right now, at least they are in the central prison as I talk with you now. I had to follow them yesterday until I made sure they are in. They have been, they were processed in. They put on their uniform today in the morning. I found them, they are shaven. At least they have an environment where they can smell the air, see the sun, and at least feel they are human being again.
So you are still proceeding with the case and making an appeal that this ruling yesterday was not fair, according to you?
Unfair, totally. I could see an innocent person convicted. I will have to appeal it only today. I could not meet my client because I was told that I should see them after 1 month, which I am still not contented with it, and I'm appealing to the prison service that this is not what the law says. They are convicted, and if they are convicted, they are free to be seen. I cannot do an appeal without seeing my clients.
That's Ajak Mayol Bior, the lawyer representing businessman Carbino Wola God. He was speaking with me from Juba earlier today. In the second part of our interview with Ajak, which airs tomorrow, he talks about the challenges facing lawyers in South Sudan. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, talks between protesters and the military junta in Khartoum resumes after a nationwide strike was called off. We'll bring details right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who makes you happy?
My family makes me happy, but mostly my aunt. She's called Aunt Percy. She makes me happy very much. She motivates me.
I personally, someone who understands me better. Like, you know what I do when I get happy, you know, and you can easily identify that I'm not happy with something. Yes, that is all that makes me happy.
Basically, me in my life, I love being with my family. I love being with people that I love, people that also love me. So when I'm around such kind of people, I feel very happy.
I'm happy when I'm spending time with my sisters. We are able to do fun stuff, like we cook together and we just spend a lot of time together, and I'm happy when I'm with them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Sudan's Transitional Military Council and the Freedom and Change Coalition have agreed to resume talks to resolve political deadlock in the country as the opposition agreed to end its civil disobedience strikes. Ethiopia's special envoy to Sudan, Mahmoud Dirir, who is mediating talks between the opposition and the military, told reporters at the Ethiopian embassy in Khartoum on Tuesday evening that the two sides have agreed to resume talks after the military junta promised to release all political detainees and the opposition called off its disobedience strike in a bid to build confidence and trust between the two parties prior to negotiations. Ambassador Dirir says both parties have expressed willingness to resume negotiations as the only means to reach a political settlement in the country. He says when the parties resume face-to-face talks, they will not renegotiate issues already agreed to earlier, including 3-year transitional period. Dirir says the parties will discuss forming a sovereign council to run the country. He also says the military and the opposition have agreed to, quote, avoid any insult or escalatory statements that would hinder the initiative, end of quote. Dirir says by sticking to these simple principles, he is confident Sudanese people will be able to overcome the current situation. The talks broke down after more than 100 protesters were gunned down and a dozen more were injured by Sudan's rapid support forces, also known as the Janjaweed, during June 3rd crackdown. The military junta suspended talks with the opposition and arrested dozens of opposition members, including SPLM North Deputy Chairman Yasser Arman and two other SPLM North officials who were expelled to Juba following mediation by the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Some Sudanese citizens say it would be good if the military junta and the opposition resume negotiations and reach a final political solution that will allow the country to move forward. 39-year-old Hilal Mohammed, who resides in Haisoura in Omdurman neighborhood, says he doesn't expect to see the parties make any progress because each side works for their own interests.
If all of them or both of them, they drop down their own issues or their thinkings, so at that time I can say that maybe they will go ahead. But currently, I don't think so.
Ahmed accuses the junta of trying to hijack the citizens' revolution, but says he still believes Sudanese citizens will eventually overcome the military. Another Sudanese citizen, Murtaz Hamid, who lives in Umbadda, Omdurman, says he hopes the two sides will return to the negotiating table with a new spirit after the recent events. Speaking in Arabic, Murtaz urges all parties to work towards building a new Sudan.
The most important thing when talks resumed is that people should trust each other and they should all work to build a new Sudan that our people have been longing for over the last 60 years.
Murtaz blames Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for fueling the conflict in his country by giving guns to the military and funding the Sudan Rapid Forces. Speaking in Arabic, Murtaz calls on the African Union to take up the lead and restore stability in Sudan.
Our main problem now is caused to us by Saudi Arabia and UAE. If they don't stop interfering with our internal affairs, Sudan will not be stable. Our hope now lays on the African Union and upon the Ethiopian Prime Minister, who is trying to bring the two parties together.
Public and private offices reopened today in and around the twin cities of Khartoum and Omdurman. The two sides did not indicate when the talks would resume. Mungu Ugale in Khartoum contributed to this story. War in the Libyan capital has been going on since early April, displacing 80,000 people. Among them are families from Sudan, Eritrea, and other countries. They fled extreme violence at home, only to be forced to flee again in Libya. VOA's Heather Murdock has this report from Tripoli in part one of a 3-part series.
Since early April, forces based in eastern Libya have been battling the forces of the country's western capital, Tripoli, and civilians have been fleeing their homes. Among them is Nafisa from Sudan, who now lives in a schoolhouse fashioned into a displacement camp. She arrived in Tripoli a week before the battle began, but this is her fourth time escaping violence. Nafisa says she was in Sudan's Darfur region in 2003 when Janjaweed soldiers burned down her village and set fire to her husband, sons, and neighbors while they were still alive. Only she and one son, Tayyib, survived. First, she fled to another village, then to a massive camp that is notoriously violent. Finally, she braved the dangerous road from Sudan to Libya. Her surviving son was kidnapped and tortured along the way. They made it to Tripoli in March, when the city was at peace, and found a suburban apartment. But 1 week later, the battle began, and Nafisa and Tayyib were forced to run from the bombing. Nafisa says she doesn't want to wait out the war here and hopes to go to Europe. The International Organization for Migration says 550 people have been killed crossing the Mediterranean Sea to Europe so far this year, and that number is expected to grow to the thousands by the end of the year. Even if they survive, they risk capture and arrest. Nafisa says she cannot go back to Sudan or stay in Tripoli. Like other people here, she says she has little to lose and will risk it all for the chance of safety. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Tripoli.
That's our show for this Wednesday. And as we have been reporting about people fleeing from South Sudan going to the neighboring countries, there's one musician in South Sudan who says he's not going anywhere. And that is Crazy Fox with this song, Anna Guide. We have been listening to Crazy Fox with the song Anna Guide, which means I have nowhere to go. I am John Tanza in Washington. I am also here and I have nowhere to go. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm a man, one,
can say I am mama, she may have my mama, I am a big group, and I'm done. Selecting new colors, supposing I'm a mama, she may have my mama.